Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 11 of the podcast and my interview with Graham Brown, who is the managing director for Lush Handmade Cosmetics in North America. Graham has been with Lush in Canada for an incredible 24 years since the brand first launched there back in 1996. The bulk of his experience was in the production and supply chain, or as he describes it, everything that happens pre-retail, before he eventually moved into the managing director role. In this episode, Graham shares his thoughts around the importance of intentionally and authentically creating your own leadership style and identity, as opposed to merely copying that of somebody else. He also speaks very candidly about feeling nervous that he wasn't up to the job, or perhaps wasn't enough to be the MD, and how he managed to keep those emotions in check. And on top of all of this, Graham shares with us a number of really granular tactics and practices that he uses to structure his days and play at his best. And then just when I thought we were done with all the learning, he threw in his thoughts on the importance of being really intentional. And there's that word again, intentional, around working on your marriage or relationships out of work. And I think we would all do well to listen to him on that, as he's just celebrated 24 years of marriage. So without any further delay, please enjoy my interview with Graham Brown, which I know you're going to absolutely love. So Graham, welcome to the show. It's absolutely fantastic to have you on today.
Ben, thank you so much. I'm really honored that you asked me, and I'm happy to have this conversation today. Really, I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. And I'm particularly appreciative because I know we were chatting just now. I know you are off enjoying a family vacation, so it makes it even more special that you've made the time.
Yeah, thank you. I wish I could share my view with you. but, you know, the family's asleep, and this is no bother for me to get up and take some time on my holiday. It's actually my pleasure. So thanks again.
Well, so go on then. Seeing as you said you wish you could share the view with us, let us all know where are you in the world and what is the view, Graham?
Oh yeah. So take your mind to Canada. I'm on the west coast in British Columbia, all the way to Vancouver Island, and I'm on a little Discovery Island. Well, it's one of the bigger islands off of Vancouver Island, on the east coast of Vancouver Island, called Quadra Island. It's across from a little town called Campbell River, where I grew up. We actually lived on Quadra for a few years as well. And we have family property still here, and spend as much time as we can over here in the summertime, Easter, Thanksgiving, that kind of stuff. We try to get over here as often as we can. And the view is like a beautiful oceanside view. We have 300 feet of frontage, waterfront property, where the view is of the mountains and the ocean as the tide comes in and out. It's just my favorite place on the planet, pretty much, in all honesty. So my little sanctuary. So I love being here.
You're making me very, very jealous. My favorite place in the world is anywhere where there's a view of the mountains. So I'm very jealous right now. But anyway, let's crack on. So the first question, Graham, I love to ask every guest for the benefit of everyone listening is, can you just tell us sort of who you are, what the current job is, and a little bit about the backstory or career journey that got you to where you are today, please?
Sure. I'll try not to ramble on too long about this. But essentially, I'm a managing director at Lush Handmade Cosmetics in Canada. We run the Canadian and US license of the Lush brand that started in the UK in 1995. So we started just shortly after them in January 96. So I've done 24 years so far. I consider myself a founding partner. It's only sweat equity that I've put in. I wasn't part of the ownership group that started, but I was fortunate enough to be in a position to be the first member of staff here in Canada. And in charge of manufacturing. So I was the production manager when I first started. And over the years, I've taken care of mostly the supply chain and production and buying and anything before the retail part of the business I was accountable for. And so that, you know, that's been an awesome journey so far. Nearly 25 years. It'd be February 2021, actually 25 years of service at Lush. And it's been my pleasure and honor to be involved in such a great company. And well, I can talk a little bit more about Lush at some point through the conversation, if you like. Prior to that, I had some production experience in sort of the sawmill industry in the west coast of Vancouver Island here. So that's where I got my production experience that helped me with starting in production realm at Lush. And then after that, I was doing my degree at Simon Fraser University and worked in the residence and housing department. So I had some sort of leadership and management training there as well. And that's where I met my wife, actually, was at university. So, you know, I wouldn't call it a hero's journey, but almost. There's lots of interesting stories throughout that arc of 24 years at Lush. I'm proud to be part of the brand. You know, COVID's had an impact on everybody, and we're doing our best. We've had quite a digital transformation through all that. But yeah, I'm extremely proud and honored to be part of that Lush brand. The journey through there, certainly learned a lot over the years through all the trials and tribulations of running a business that was at first quite small, but soon evident that it was going to be popular. And we have 265 shops approximately in North America that we're in charge of, along with a couple of manufacturing facilities and distribution, East Coast and West Coast of Canada that supply Canada and the US. And it's about a global brand of about $1.5 billion sales pounds, I believe. And then we're just under 950 shops worldwide.
Right. So, yeah. So I'd love to come in a few seconds to asking some questions around those lessons you've learned. But I've got to ask, seeing as you've been there for 24, nearly 25 years, like what's kept you in the one business for that length of time? Because it's pretty incredible these days to find somebody who's got that sort of length of tenure somewhere.
Oh, well, if I think about that, there's a couple of things. I guess I can give myself a bit of credit for part of that. You know, it takes a bit of grit and perseverance and patience in a way, and loyalty to say, okay, I've made this choice. And while we're building something, you know, there's going to be ups and downs, and you sort of think about sticking with it. Because it's for sure cliche, but there's a lot of gold and truth in cliches, right? Like, I think it was first Zig Ziglar. I remember listening to a audio recording of his, and he's like describing people digging for oil or drilling for water, whatever analogy you want, and people stopping just before they reach the intended bounty, right? So my closest version of that was, there's for sure I've been engaged in the brand the whole time, but definitely throughout the arc of that history, you think about what it would be like to potentially be doing something else. And I think if I had listened to some of my stories that I was creating about leaving or thinking about leaving to try different challenges, I would have missed probably the biggest upswing of growth in our business, which was essentially between 2014 and 2017. So, you know, there's a bit of a history lesson there, and sometimes sticking with it is the right thing. You have to pick your moments. Sometimes sticking with something isn't, you know, if you have to do it for the right reasons. But so that's the part I'd like to give myself a tiny bit of credit for. Of course, the other side of the coin is it's a fantastic brand. Like, we really are up to more than just trading retail goods and hoping people buy the product. It's like we have a story behind the product and why we do it in the first place, in terms of environmental initiatives and all sorts of good reasons around the products themselves. And then we really turned into an ethical campaigning company as well, to try to at least raise awareness, not be a, you know, holier than thou, stand on a soapbox and pretend that we're better than everybody else, but sort of raise awareness around issues that we believe are important, and try to really do good things on the planet for essentially the environment, as I mentioned, and people, humanitarian and environmental and animal rights causes as well. So I think the entrepreneurial journey, the learning that I've had, so that's the last piece I'll just add to that, is that I've always thought I would stay with something as long as I'm learning and growing and feeling that I'm contributing and adding value. So I just felt like I had enough variability in my day-to-day activity and how the business was growing, and I was contributing and learning a whole heck of a lot. So that's really what's kept that. Hopefully that answers that question, what's kept me around for so long.
Yeah, and I've heard you probably use the word learning and growing 5-6 times. If you went back and counted, maybe it's more, which is really interesting to me. So what have been some of the biggest lessons you've learned throughout your time at Lush, especially in regards to leading, being a senior leader, being an MD? What are some of those big leadership lessons been for you?
Yeah, leadership is interesting. I think that regardless of your title, you know, and I'll borrow Robin Sharma's book about that, The Leader Who Had No Title. I learned that quite from an early age with my dad. He was a school administrator, a vice principal, and he talked about, you know, how the importance of leadership throughout an organization, and how he treated the janitor the same as anyone else, and the valuing that person's opinion and role in being a leader in the school. And so I remember thinking about that early on as a young man. And then throughout my leadership journey, I certainly people think leaders have all the answers, and I definitely don't think we do. I think one of the biggest learnings that I would say is that you have to be humble enough to say, as a leader, regardless of your title, to not pretend to know everything, to be able to use your team and ask them for input, and just be authentic and say, look, I don't know, I don't have all the answers always, and just be humble about that is one of the first things that pops to mind, Ben, and that was a bit easier for me in a way, because we started quite small, and so there was very few people. But as the business grows and your tenure and number of years goes on, then people do look at you as a subject matter expert and sort of looking for a little more direction and leadership at times too. So you always try to balance stepping up when needed as far as leading, but also being humble and asking for your team for their side. And I think that I would say that's one of my biggest things for success, is to enroll the team and lead and make sure they're really bought into the decisions versus just handing decisions to the folks you're working with. It definitely works better. It can be longer and harder and less efficient appearing at times to go that route, but definitely enrolling people in the decisions and being transparent, fully transparent about everything has been super important.
Yeah, I'm curious on the piece around humility as well. It's a really strong theme that's come up in nearly all of the podcast interviews that I've done so far. Like, is that humility and being humble something that comes to you very naturally, where you don't even need to think about it? Or is sort of being humble, staying connected to maybe more junior people in the organization, really asking for their input and ideas? Or is that something that you sort of consciously have to work at?
I tell you what it is for me, Ben, that I think some humility and being humble, that's a bit of who I am, I think, as a person anyways. So that's, and the reason I can say that is I like to sing and perform, you know, in small bands and things like that, but I'm a bit of a reluctant performer that way. And so I'm not interested in attention. And sort of, oh, look at me, and I'm singing and performing. And I think as a leader, I'm the same way. I don't like to be front and center and sort of, hey, everybody listen to me talk. So I'm a bit of a reluctant leader that way. And I'm also more about the team than sort of my own individual role in the organization. You have to balance that with your own confidence, though, and style. And so I think that where I've had to work at it is that some of the other leaders in Lush Global and other businesses I've been in have different styles of leadership. And of course you want people to appreciate who you are and how you lead. And so sometimes you're apt to try to copy the other leader's styles. And so I've sometimes bumped up against leading in a way that wasn't really my own way of leading, and trying to be somebody else and lead like they're leading, because I thought that's what they wanted or that's what they know and understand. So I tried to emulate and copy that. And that, I always found that didn't work so well. And some of that type of leadership, the way they led was sort of never admitting any fault or never showing lack of confidence, and being strong. And maybe that works for them. And sometimes there is a role for that in an organization of someone you can always count on is going to be positive and charging ahead and leading that way. It's just not for me. So I think where I've had to work at it is to I think I had the humility down, but maybe too far at times. And sometimes people need confidence and boldness and leadership and take charge. And we're doing this because sometimes groups get in an impasse and they want someone to make a judgment call. So that's the part I've had to balance and work hard at a little bit. But you know, I don't know. I think it's a game and it's an ebb and flow, to be honest. It's not a fixed way of being. You have to change the tactics for different circumstances, I would say as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. And are there any particular sort of leadership models, tools, frameworks that you sort of rely on or fall back on as a leader, Graham?
Yeah, let's see. That's a great question. I thought about some of the things around principles and, you know, there's some principles around lifelong learner, being a lifelong learner and a growth mindset that I think applies to leadership and applies to all sorts of fields and whether you're a leader or not. As I said earlier, I think everyone is a leader for themselves and their family and their work groups, regardless of title. So I think that's the main one, is the principle of there is no fixed way of being, of growing, of learning, of being continually of the mind to increase your understanding and consciousness as best you can about yourself. It starts with self and your own self-awareness, and then it branches out into other subject matter as well. But I think to continually learn and to reevaluate, for example, getting good at giving and receiving feedback is just one tactic that there's lots of granular books about that and things like that. But I would say that that's one that that's an idea that everyone should take on, is like, it's hard actually at times to give and receive feedback in an effective manner, especially to receive feedback. I think we're probably better at giving feedback generally. Although I personally can avoid difficult conversations at times, but anyways, I'm sorry. I can go off. I'm so excited to share. So I can go off on a tangent real quick. You can reel me back in anytime, Ben, but that's the principle of being a lifelong learner.
Don't worry about going off on tangents. Someone recently described my podcast as being like a jazz set, which is the beginning's really structured. The middle is pretty loose and free flow. And then we come back to some structure at the end, which as a format I quite like. So don't worry.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, I was going to say another sort of framework. I mean, I kind of look at it when you're talking in the leadership realm, but there's sort of a financial framework that I look at. And there's some models that are a little bit related to life. And so one of the models that I find that helps me be a more effective leader is sort of this idea of designing your week. It's a weekly design system. I think the format I actually borrowed from Robin Sharma from one of his events, where you take a piece of paper. In this case, I've transitioned to an electronic copy of it. And I write out my week with some daily gratitude practice, some business and personal objectives and intentions for the week. I have an electronic calendar, of course, in my, you know, in my digital devices, but I find handwriting something out that has a kinesthetic feel to it that I really enjoy and connects differently with my brain. So writing some stuff out each day and for the week has what I've found is that it's made me much more effective. It's made me miss less appointments, because you know how we kind of these things pop up on our phones. I find that that's helpful, but that's only one way to keep yourselves organized. I find writing stuff out is really helpful, and layering and journaling and intentions and gratitude practice has been super helpful for me to, you know, slow down at times to then have a capacity to speed up and get everything done. So that's one sort of model. Financially, I think there's one in terms of that I'll talk about later if we get into sort of books and things like that that we're have been inspired by. And framework, I don't know how to answer the framework part apart from, yeah, I think I mentioned it before about the title part where being a leader is something that should be thought about regardless of the title you're at and have in the organization. And so I'll just pause at that part from there, because I'm kind of losing my train of thought in terms of answering your question in an effective way.
Yeah, no worries. I'd love to just take you back to that slowing down to speed up comment you just made. Like, that's a phrase that you hear quite a lot. And with some of my work, some of the people I talk to, I often talk about that. But sometimes the response I get is, oh, great, Ben, but I've just got so much stuff on. I can't slow down. I've just got to plow on and get through all the stuff. I'd love the luxury of sitting down for 20 minutes and reflecting in my journal with a kind of nice cup of coffee, but I've just got so much stuff to get on. Like, what do you say to those people, and how have you made that work, and what impact have you seen from that process of slowing down to speed up?
Yeah, well, without any judgment, I've been there. I've been one of those persons that said, oh, I'd love to have time to do XYZ. What I'd probably tell myself looking back, or some folks that are commenting or asking that question of when you're bringing that up, is you might want to take a look about what you're avoiding yourself by staying in that busy state. You know, so what am I avoiding by being with my own thoughts quietly for a little while? Staying busy is a choice. So what, you know, is there something that I'm maybe keeping myself busy to avoid looking at, or maybe postpone, delay what I know I really need to do or think about, or give myself some space to pause? Or what am I attaching my own self-worth to in terms of doing something and keeping myself busy and active at it? You know, we all have things to do, but it's just that frantic, oh, I wish I had 20 minutes. We all can structure our lives to have 20 minutes for ourselves. For sure, we can do that if we want to. It's just, it's getting close to connected to why you might want to do that. And so that's probably something that I'd offer up, solicited or unsolicited advice if someone was to ask is yeah, just take a look quickly. Challenge yourself. Really, can I not set aside some time? That's probably a bit of a story we've created for ourselves to keep things the same. And there's nothing wrong with staying the same either, but it's sort of like, if you do want to try some things on, nothing will work unless you give it a try, right? So, yeah, that would be my first answer to that.
And what was it that made the change for you? Because you said, like, I was one of those people who said, I've just not got time for this. Like, can you remember back the point where it changed and you took a different approach?
Yeah, I can. I think the first time I really took a look at it was I went to a weekend experience called the Landmark Forum. And it just sort of, it was like a 3-day, full day training weekend where you spent some long days in a group conversation led by a facilitator. And it just sort of challenged all your thought processes about things that have happened to you in the past and whether they're actually in your past or whether you have them running what you're doing on a day-to-day basis now, today. Like what's in your past is actually in your present right now, if you haven't actually had any closure on it. So it was an interesting experience. So that was my first sort of experience that made me think, oh, maybe what I'm wearing and what I'm doing isn't for me. Maybe what am I doing this for actually? So that was the first sort of entry into it. And then later on, I continue my own sort of self-development and education journey. And I just continue to read and go to different events and experiences. And it came up often was like this idea of morning practices and mindfulness techniques and things like that. And I hadn't really done that for myself before, at least not deliberately. I think I'd learned to listen to some audio tapes as a kid to get to sleep and things like that. So maybe I learned a form of meditation and things, but it just came up over and over again in podcasts I was listening to and books I was reading about taking some time for mindfulness. And so I thought, oh, I should try that out. But, you know, connecting to the Lush journey I was on, I think I was just so desperate to provide value and be of service to the organization that I didn't put myself first at times. And so I would charge ahead and be busy with my list of things. But I found out there's times where my fulfillment around that was being challenged. I'm like, well, why am I not happy with what I'm up to? I'm engaged. I'm in a great brand. I'm doing well. But however, there's something that's bothering me just for me. And so I think my capacity to carry on for all those years has been helped by just taking some time for myself to be centered around what do I want? What are my needs? And what comes up for me when I pause a little bit and stop the busyness of my list of to-dos and think of it a little more holistically about what's good for me. And I look at it that way now. That's for sure a principle that I have now, which is, yeah, start with yourself. If you want to be in service of others, you have to be in a good spot for yourself first. And then that gives you the capacity to go out and hopefully make an impact and to be there for other people, including your family.
Yeah,
and
it kind of sounds like I've heard you come full circle, Graham. And at the start, you was mentioning sort of grit and determination and resilience, I think, being one of the things that partly kept you at Lush and that you needed to stay at Lush. And now it sounds like actually by stepping back, slowing down to speed up, investing some time in yourself, that sort of gave you the ability to have that grit and determination to keep going.
That's totally fair. And, you know, it's hard to pinpoint one thing as a cause and effect for staying or going, but I would say I'm pretty sure that if I hadn't been on the specific leadership journey and self-development journey that I've been on from about 2015 to today, I think I would have, through some of the changes, had been not quite over myself, and I would have just thought the best thing I could do was withdraw myself, my services, thinking that would have been the best thing to do. There's been some times where I've been challenged with my own emotions and my own emotionality, and you know, sometimes we think, oh well, what I'll do is I'll just stop, and that will do something. But I think it would have had the wrong result. So COVID aside, that's been a big thing for everybody to deal with. But the reason I mention it is just because, yeah, I think that change management in organizations and in your own situation, if you haven't equipped yourself with tools to help you navigate through those things, at least for myself anyways, at times you feel like your only option is to move on and do something different. I'm pretty sure if I hadn't been on the journey that I've been on, then I might have done 20 years at Lush, but I don't think I'd be heading into my 25th year. And that it's not because of the business. That's just because of my own getting over myself, essentially.
Yeah. And Graham, what advice would you give to someone who's moving into their first role as an MD of a business? If you could give just one piece of advice, what would it be?
I think don't be afraid to be a beginner. You know, don't bump up against needing to be an expert for everybody. Continue to learn, be open and authentic. So don't lead like you think somebody should. Learn to develop your own leadership style that works for you. It needs to work for the organization, of course, but yeah, really over the years, craft your and be intentional with your leadership style and make sure that it's congruent with who you are. And you know, it's okay to emulate other leaders and take bits that might work for yourself, but be adaptive and start to think about crafting your own leadership style that's authentic to you, is what I would say.
And I've not asked this question before, but it just occurred to me whilst we've been chatting. Like, are there any particular feelings you would tell people to be aware of or anticipate as they sort of step into that MD role on the first day? Or I guess another way to ask the question is, like, when you stepped into that role, like, how did it feel, and were there any feelings that caught you off guard, almost like, wow, I wasn't expecting to feel this way on day one? What was that like?
My own personal experience, and I'm sure there's others that have bumped up against this, is the feelings of whether you're going to be good enough or whether you are enough. You know, am I good enough? Am I enough, you know, for this role, for what I'm being asked to do, for my family? Like, I bump up against that all the time. And right when you said feelings, I think for me, that's the main one that screams for me and that I've been working on is, yeah, it's just, you want to be of value, be of service, and be a leader. And so I think those feelings of whether you're enough, I think you have to, as uncomfortable as those can be at times, it's probably just a signal for yourself of growth and to just evaluate whether you're providing the value you need to. Just be careful it doesn't get too spiral downward thinking in terms of I'm not enough. I think it's okay to have am I enough feelings. It's just be aware of it going too far the other way, right? So that's that fine line I was talking about of confidence and also humility. So that's it for me anyways, from a feeling perspective. So I think it's natural to feel that. And so if leaders are stepping into new roles, just embrace it and say, yeah, I am enough, and have that growth mindset of, and you know, you can always build teams around you and also change your practices to improve. So have that growth mindset.
Yeah, I really appreciate that answer, Graham. Actually, I think to the answer you gave in sharing that, I think it demonstrates a real sort of strength of character, because there's an element of vulnerability, I think, in sharing what you've just shared. My experience is, like, especially male leaders, they don't share kind of that vulnerability and talk about they have those feelings. Am I enough? Am I up to this? Or certainly they don't share it outwardly with kind of colleagues, maybe not even kind of loved ones at home. Mm-hmm. But again, my experience is, as I kind of coach and mentor senior leaders, as I get to know them over time, a number of sessions in, all of what you just shared, like, starts to come out behind closed doors, but they still don't kind of share it that often, or if they do, it's deeply uncomfortable, sort of saying, you know what, guys, kind of at times I'm nervous, I'm not sure what the right way ahead here is. But I think when we do share some of that and open up, I think it really helps people understand us as a leader and shows some real strength of character. But of course, we have to kind of, we can't all the time say I don't have the answers and be vulnerable all the time. But doing it now and then when the time is right, I think it's just agree with you wholeheartedly on that last comment, and appreciate the fact that you shared it.
Yeah, no problem. I agree.
Cool. So I'm conscious of time and wanting to be respectful of your time. So to close out the jazz set, as it were, I've got a few slightly more quick fire questions to finish up on.
Excellent.
The first one is, what are sort of one or two books that have really had a big impact upon you, generally in life or in terms of leadership?
Sure. One that comes to mind is a couple of books by an author named Robert Kiyosaki. The first one was Rich Dad, Poor Dad. But I think the follow-up book to that, Cash Flow Quadrant, was one of the big ones that, you know, I think it shifted my paradigm around employee, self-employed, business owner, investor, early on in my sort of between university and working days, where, you know, there was a series of programming for a while for a lot of us anyways, not everybody, but where the program was go to school, get good grades, get a good job, start saving for retirement. And you know, you may have a pension, either self-directed benefits, or you might get a pension if you're lucky enough. And then that's what your life arc is. And I was sort of on that path a little bit. And then I read Rich Cashflow Quadrant, and it sort of just challenged my thinking around finances and started making me think a little bit more about being a business owner and an investor as well. Nothing wrong with being an employee or self-employed, but it can be limited in terms of flexibility and earnings and taxes and things like that. So, you know, I'm a bit of a real estate investor as well, and that came from that book. So you never underestimate the power of reading a book like that or something else. So that was one that's probably made a big impact upon me from that perspective. There's other ones around leadership as well, but there's a pair of books that I read in the last four years that had a big impact on me. And one was Elon Musk book, and then Zero to One by Peter Thiel, where he mentioned Elon Musk as well. And I think just around there, it was around, I got really connected to, if you're have a purpose that's massive and so much bigger than yourself, can be a guiding principle through challenging times, right? So I really got that from that particular set of books, is both this perspective of, yeah, it doesn't have to be the same as Elon Musk. I'm not pretending that I'm trying to emulate what he's doing, but it's quite admirable though where you're literally trying to transition the world's economy from off of fossil fuels to sustainable energy. The fact that he chose cars as the first way to start with that is great, but he said no one would start a car company in their right mind, right? So you're not starting from a profitability point of view or anything. You're doing something way, way, way bigger than yourself. And he seems to have this massive reservoir of energy to draw from when you have a mission that big. And then Peter Thiel talked about in his Zero to One book that he, you know, if you're, there's a lot of companies that were greenwashing and talking about environmental practices, but you know, he mentioned Elon Musk is different there. So right when that happened, I really got connected to that, and I even invested in some shares in Tesla and so on, which just seems like a smart thing to do now, but it was coming, you know, quite sketchy for a while. Anyways, my point being is those are two books and sets of books, different reasons that have really impacted me in recent years and early years back with Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yeah, cool. What's the actual title of the Elon Musk one?
I'm purely asking for my
benefit now, rather than the listeners, because he's an interesting guy for me.
Yeah, I think if I recall correctly, it's just called Elon Musk. There's a writer that helped him do it, but it's not an autobiography or anything. But I believe the book is just called Elon Musk, if I'm not mistaken. And the other one's 0 to 1.
I'm going out to buy that one.
Peter Thiel.
Cool. And what are you reading or learning about right now?
I'm reading fiction right now. It's an Ayn Rand book called Atlas Shrugged. I read Fountainhead a couple of years ago, really enjoyed it, and this is her follow-up. It's a great big thick book, and so I'm probably only about a quarter of the way through, but I'm really enjoying it. It's a bit of a period piece, or back in the railway days. So I'm reading that one right now. What I found interesting about those is it's about being principled in a different way. The Fountainhead book is about an architect that would just refuse to compromise on his brand of architecture. So I recommend that one. And then Atlas Shrugged is good so far, really good so far as well. From a learning perspective, my wife and I have read a book by John Gottman. It's called 8 Dates. And it's a series of dates you go out with your partner. We've completed all 8 dates, and then there's a bonus date where we've taken the concept of this bonus date where you take letters of the alphabet and you talk about things you cherish about your partner. Well, instead of taking it as one date, we're taking each letter of the alphabet as a date, and we're listing out the things that we cherish about our partner. And I think we're on letter D right now. But there's a whole series of like relationship and communication principles. I really, really appreciate John Gottman's work, and him and his wife have done an extremely good job. There's podcasts, there's a lot of good material that they've put together, and it's really helped us recently with navigating some things we had been avoiding talking about difficult conversations. We've had a really fantastic relationship over the past 26 years of being together and 21 years of marriage. However, the cliche about needing to work at it is totally true, I would say. And so that's something we're learning, is how to optimize our communication and be intentional actually with the date part. That's another sort of cliche thing, but yeah, you sit date night, having a weekly date night as a couple, so important to actually make time to do that. Why do we put other things in our calendar and not do that for our partners is beyond me at times. And so, well, beyond myself, I can't believe we've had so many years of go by of not being as intentional as we could have been with that. So really enjoying that.
Amazing. Before we hit record there, we was chatting, weren't we, about, was it just last week you said your 21st wedding anniversary?
Yeah, August 7th. We actually got married on this little island called Quadra Island as well. So that's part of why we love coming back here. And yeah, we just enjoyed our 21st anniversary, got away for a couple of days. And my wife is really the secret to my success, in all honesty, because family is first. And I don't think I'd been able to achieve what I've been able to achieve, which pretty much included about a week per month of travel for over many years. Obviously not recently with COVID, but for her to be the rock of being back home and being with the family, I wouldn't be able to do what. So really, everything I've achieved has been done together, absolutely. And so it's really good to take some time away together and to honor that every year. And I think most of us do a reasonable job of that. I encourage everybody to think about it even more granularly in doing the weekly date stuff, for sure.
Yeah, I think coming from a man who's been married for 21 years, I'll really take your advice, and I'm going to go out and buy 8 dates as well and add that to the reading list. That's fantastic. Final question, Graham. Do you have any particular routines or ways of working or particular habits that you find really, really effective, or even any that are a little bit kind of quirky or maybe unusual?
Okay, well, for me, there's two types of working that I find effective for me. So if I'm doing something where it's a clear volume of work where it's sort of routine, repetitive, like let's say it's a weekend of work on a project where you're going to do a forecast in a spreadsheet, and so it's quite deliberate, you're working through a long list of things. So if it's that type of work, what I'll do is pick a song that I've been liking listening to recently. There's a few that I go to actually, and I just put the same song on repeat. Over and over again on a loop. And so I've done that. Some of my favorite memories are putting a song on repeat, being in a lock myself in a quiet space and work on that project for the whole weekend. you know, obviously breaks here and there, but just full on, just go for it with the song on repeat. You almost get into the sort of flow state, I find, with that. I can't listen to variable music and different things going on in the background when I'm trying to concentrate. But if you put on one song on repeat for that type of work, I find that that's a granular tactic I just wanted to share.
Very cool.
When it's other type of work, for me, myself personally, if it's creative stuff type things and all that, what I like to do is, I actually, maybe not surprised to you or to some of the listeners that may be listening, is I like to talk through things. So I put myself in little work pods with at least somebody else, because I find I definitely have to have my alone time as well. But then when I need to create something, I find it really effective to talk through and create something in a small group, either as pairs or with a few people. And I usually ask for support with someone else helping me with taking notes and maybe we're actually recorded as well. But yeah, verbally talking through and surrounding yourself with people that have skills or note-taking and other ability that maybe you don't have is helpful. Another one, which is just sort of tools and tactics, is I create a file folder for each and every calendar month. I've done that for probably close to the whole 24 years at Lush. So, you know, for example, even on a vacation, I have a August 2021 folder. Any project, any file that gets shared with me, file that I create, goes into that folder. That's the way that I organize. It works for me. I'm not saying that will work for everybody, but it's been really helpful for me to find things and sort of look back and structure my years. And then I already shared that I do that weekly schedule every week as well. And then I use a lot of tools like Notability and Evernote. Evernote is a great actual tool that I use that I keep everything there, and I use tags to help me organize some of my random thoughts and files. So if I go back and work on income taxes later on in the year, for example, we filed it at the end of June, I believe it was, it extended from April. I've already pretty much tagged all the right files that I need for 2019 income tax, so I don't have to go back and take as long to find everything later on. So
yeah, very cool.
Yeah, just some granular tactics mixed with some philosophies on working. Surrounding yourself with people that complement your skills or your lack thereof. And for me, it's verbally talking through things, or try the song on repeat too. That's an interesting way to get a big volume of routine work done.
Amazing. We've just hit about 40 minutes, which is a real shame, because I feel like we could carry on chatting for another hour. So I don't necessarily say this to every guest, but it'd be great maybe to get you back in the future for another chat on season two or three potentially. It's been absolutely fantastic chatting to you.
I would love to, Ben, and you know, I really hope I provide some value. I get value of just reflecting and talking to you. And so I hope I've been of any service to you or any of the listeners. And the reason I'm honored to be asked is that, for me, I think that's one of my life purposes, is just to be on my own journey. And then if there's anything I can share or glean and help others to get with what's important to them, I get such a big boost of energy just from that itself. So I'm totally interested in doing anything in the future. And I like the Q&A format too, because it kind of draws out stuff that you may not be currently thinking of. So I've had a big boost of energy myself, and so thank you for inviting me.
Amazing. You can definitely remove hope, because I can tell you it will definitely provide value to the listeners. It's definitely provided value to me. So thank you very much. Take care and enjoy the rest of your vacation.
Thanks, Ben. All the best to you and family, and hope to see you again soon when the traveling opens up again.
So there you have it, folks, my interview with Graham Brown from Lush Handmade Cosmetics. I think that episode was packed full of wisdom, as well as some really granular tactics that we could all take away and try using. If you found the episode helpful, then it would be amazing if you could share it via your social media. And please do also head over to iTunes and subscribe, as it enables us to keep growing the podcast and bringing you more and more interviews with senior leaders such as Graham. That's it for this episode, folks. I will see you all again soon, and lead on.